You're listening to episode 1 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hello, my fellow storytellers. Before we get right into my very first interview, I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. Scrivener is a tool that helps writers bring their stories to life. I use Scrivener to gather all my thoughts, ideas, and research in an organized way that makes writing the chapters so much easier for me. Stay tuned for a featured interview with Julia Pierce, the head of marketing at Scrivener, at the end of this episode to find out why she uses Scrivener, the one feature she absolutely loves, and the very special promo code just for our tribe of storytellers. Good morning, and today we have the amazing Katie Wesch with us.
Hi.
Katie, thank you so much for being here today. I'm so excited to have you as my first interviewee. I'm very, very honored. And Katie and I met on her Disney feature film that she wrote called Prom. And so a little bit about Katie. Katie's worked on Fox's Prison Break. Her first feature script, Prom, was released by Disney and was Blacklist nominated. And since then has written and produced many hours of cable and network television, including the CW's Secret Circle, ABC's Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, and CBS's Vegas. She's currently a producer on the hit TNT series Rizzoli and Isles. And can I add, she has a beautiful family, two gorgeous babies, and she's seriously so kick-ass. I don't know how she does it. She's a superwoman. So, Katie, thank you again for being here today.
Thank you.
I know that for me, when I write a little bit on the side, and even if I have something that's been published, it's been published on Amazon. But for me, I still feel a little bit uncomfortable owning up to the word being a writer. So for you, when did you start feeling comfortable calling yourself a writer?
It's a great question, and I think a very familiar conflict. I had the same feeling when I was first starting out. I would tell people I was a writer, especially when I would go back home to Michigan where I'm from, and people would say, what do you write? And you feel like if you can't tell them an Oscar award-winning movie, then it must be some fraud. But it actually is a conversation between you and yourself over a long period of years, I think, where you just get comfortable in that identity. And I think it comes through the hours spent at the computer or with the notebook, where you just really begin to understand how you express yourself and why you are driven to do this and why, you know, you're willing to suffer through what it takes to ultimately make a living doing it. And I think that is like the identity is sort of forged, I think, that way rather than just ultimately adopted.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like it's like psychologically letting them know, like, okay, if you haven't published anything or written anything to what you think the society expects or defines a writer being, then you calling yourself a writer, subconsciously, you're going to keep creating, you're going to keep writing, and eventually that will happen. When you do write at home, you are a writer. You're currently working at your craft. It's like an actor. What, you're not an actor because you haven't booked something? That's so not true. You're at your theater class working so hard in your classes, and that's considered being an actor. Same thing with a writer. So I resonate with that.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I mean, I think the important thing to remember is that the names of writers and actors and directors who we all recognize and look up to and aspire to didn't start out being those people, right? Everybody has that part of their career where they're anonymous and maybe feel like they're floundering or even failing. And that is as much a part of the path as the accolades and awards and recognition ultimately. But it takes a long time to really know it. Somebody can tell it to you a lot, but it takes a while to really get it, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the whole journey of life, just to realize failures can make it so much more exciting in your journey of life.
Yeah.
If you keep getting all these accolades, then it's kind of like you haven't really learned what's the meaning of being a human being. It's really about the strength and rising back up and keep fighting for what it is that you want. So I do feel that. So Katie, can you let us know a little bit about how you got into writing? What sparked your love? Was it maybe you wrote like a story when you were younger as a kid and then you just fell in love with it and and just kept at it?
Yeah, it's true. I always did write. I wrote plays when I was a kid, and I always was interested in writing fiction stories. But when I finally got to college, I realized I took a screenwriting class, and I was an English major, but I had taken this class kind of on a lark, and it was like the hardest thing I'd ever tried to do, I think for a lot of reasons, but mostly, you know, you have so few words to work with. I had a writing teacher who described screenwriting as the thong bikini of writing lingerie.
I love that.
You have to be really clear about what it is you're trying to say, and then you have to find a way to say it through action. And not, you know, you have to show and not tell, as everyone knows. So in order to really be able to do that, to find a gesture or an action that really captures a character or really advances a story in a way that, you know, is efficient and effective and not completely trite, was extremely hard for me. And so that challenge became something I couldn't let go of. And I went ultimately from that one class in college to graduate school at USC film school, and I got a master's degree in writing for cinema and television, and, you know, sort of continued trying to figure exactly how I would express myself in this genre. And it continues to be hard, although I certainly have more practice at it now.
Yeah, that's so inspiring for us to hear. And thank you for sharing that, by the way. And Katie, I'd love to know what you recommend for people who are transitioning careers and realizing that they have a knack for telling stories, but they just have no idea how to get started or how to get their foot in the door to create opportunities for themselves. Do you recommend in these situations they go back to school for writing?
Most people are very valuable. I mean, I think in features as well as television, people who have life experience outside of college and graduate school, it's a lot to bring when you then become a writer, that you have all that experience to draw from. And I think the answer is different for different people. Some people really thrive in an academic environment. They can embrace the identity of student long enough to give themselves the space they need to figure out what stories they even want to be telling. Other people might already have that story in them. And then it's a matter of figuring out the right way to get your material to the right people. I think the thing that's interesting about this business, this at the same time that it can be frustrating, is that everyone's path is circuitous. No two people take the same road to get to the same destination. And that's why it's an interesting conversation, right? But it's somewhat, I think, frustrating sometimes for people who are looking for that direct path. For me personally, while I always started out wanting to be a feature writer, my first actual job in the business was as an assistant in television. I was, you know, bringing coffee to people. And so I ultimately kind of climbed the ranks of television and television writing because that was the first job I landed. I mean, it was really as simple as that. And so while I was at home at night writing my feature screenplays that I thought would be my big movie break, I was kind of having a television career on the side. And it's always been that way, that I've had a foot in both worlds. And sometimes the feature career comes to the forefront, like it did for Prom when I worked at Disney. And at other times it falls back and becomes a night and weekend gig, like a Disney Channel movie that I'll be rewriting, or a Lifetime movie, or something that I'll be doing on the side while during the day I'm working in a television writer's room. So, you know, as I say, everybody's path is a little bit different. But I think that those people who come to this career with some measure of life experience preceding it are very valuable and fascinating in the room. There was a writer on Prison Break who started in later seasons who had been in the military for a while and had served in Iraq. And he ended up being just like this incredibly useful resource. And it would have been a great shame if he had gone to film school instead of found a way to get into that writer's room with all of that experience from which we all benefited. Maybe that's not the most direct answer, but it's an honest one.
Yeah, no, I love that. So Katie, can you tell us a little bit more about your specific journey? I know you mentioned a lot, and I love that. But specifically about how you got into being an assistant for Fox. Was there an internship that was posted through USC School of Cinema?
Although a lot of jobs are discovered that way, it never hurts to go kind of haunt the bulletin boards and just kind of keep your ear to the ground, get yourself on as many email lists as you can, Facebook groups as you can. Because when those job listings get posted, you know, you can kind of throw your hat into the ring. And it was some similar way that I think I found my way to Prison Break. I think that a former graduate, somebody who had graduated in the years before me, was getting staffed on that show, Prison Break, the first season it was on the air. And he sent out like a general email blast, saying, we're staffing assistants in this office if anybody wants to come work on this new TV show, which is the kind of email that one would get a lot. And usually, you know, you don't get the job, or it's not right, or it's shooting in New York. But this one, the timing was pretty great. And so I managed to, you know, kind of leverage my relationship with him to get in. And I would say that is, as you've, I'm sure, heard before from other people, kind of the singular reason to go to film school, in my opinion, is that you do get these relationships with people that ultimately, you know, will benefit you down the road in ways you can't anticipate. So maybe you don't make, you know, a short film that wins the Palme d'Or while you're at school, or maybe you don't even get a job right out of school because of having gone there. But down the road somewhere, you're going to cross paths with somebody, you know, and you have this background in common, and that has its benefits. So in that way, you know, film school has served me very well.
Yeah, I could see that. I think I see a lot of people succeeding because of collaborations, because of the people that they've met, and they become really good friends and realize that they have so much in common and the same type of vision. Yeah. And then they end up coming together and making something so beautiful that does a lot of times end up winning awards later on, you know? So Katie, can you tell us a little bit about the proudest moment in your career?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It was, it's funny. It was certainly like a singular moment to get a movie made and have a sole credit on a produced feature from Disney. That was a really highlight for me, because it came together so beautifully, and it was such a satisfying creative experience. And then to sort of see it on the other side was really great. But everything about the experience was great. So what I would say is, as many times as one might close her eyes and imagine her name on the screen or herself winning some sort of recognition, ultimately what was great and defining about that experience for me was everything that preceded the moment of the premiere. In other words, I felt that I was creatively, professionally ready for it when it came. I felt like I was able to contribute and get from the experience everything that I could. So it was a much more holistic kind of satisfaction. And I think that that is why it takes so long sometimes. My grandfather used to say, despite all the technology we have in the world today, it still takes 9 months to make a baby.
I love that.
I do too. And I really think what he meant by it was, like, some things just take as long as they take. There's a reason for it. You might not like it. You might not understand it. But in the end, it's like, just trust that process. And that's how having my movie made felt to me.
You know, you said something interesting, that you were able to contribute a lot. So I know a lot of times, and people write something, it gets changed from their original storyline or concept. How close do you think Disney's Prom, towards the end, stayed true to your original vision and storyline without being too diluted by other writers and producers and their comments?
Well, I mean, fortunately, I had the very unusual situation of having the script the whole time. I never lost control of it. So all of the changes that were made by me, with the exception of one brief polish that was done by another very talented writer. So in fact, the script was improved by her hand. But I had control of it for the whole time, me, of course, and Joe Nussbaum, the director. So I would say that I participated in the evolution of the script from start to finish. And because it's a studio movie, I think there's a different kind of question when it comes to this notion of a vision and how true it can remain to the writer or the director or anyone's single vision, because there's a lot of money at stake, right? And there are a lot of participants in the making of a movie. At the end, even someone like Yin Chang is going to inform and change a character that I create when she brings it to life as an actress, right? So I would say it felt both true to what I envisioned initially and also true to how it ultimately evolved that I never could have foreseen. And I think being flexible around that concept, particularly in the studio, the very commercial sort of studio system, is how you survive as a writer. And in television, it's the same, of course. A defining aspect of your job is giving and getting notes. So in order to really kind of weather that It's about, okay, how can I make the changes that are being asked of me and do the best possible version of it that I can do, and always keep in mind the larger picture of the story I'm trying to tell. And when you can kind of hold all of those in one basket, it's surprising to learn that the story can actually change very significantly, and you can still have a very satisfying, surprising result that you might even like better. But early in your career, I think it's hard to accept that. I think notes are hard to take, and it feels like somebody is encroaching upon your idea and you want to be protective. And all of those instincts, I think, are also valid. We get beat up a lot, creative people. So I think that that's a constant kind of battle. But Prom was a really good example of how something evolves over time. And I think in the end, we were happy with where it ended up, even though it was different from where it started.
Yeah, absolutely. And from an actor's point of view, working with you guys on set, you could definitely tell there was such a collaborative spirit. You guys were all so down to earth, so receptive, and so hardworking. It was really cool for me to observe that and to have you guys as role models now that I'm venturing more into writing and learning more about the importance of collaborating and taking and receiving notes to better improve the project as a whole. And Katie, I feel like it's almost inevitable for us to feel stuck at certain points in our lives or our careers, and at certain points to even feel like failures, because some of us compare ourselves to what our parents or society expects from us. Was there a time where you felt stuck in a lull?
Well, you know, I often say that I had writer's block for 2 years, because when I graduated from film school, you know, I was in my mid-20s and I didn't have a job and I didn't have any real applicable skills with an English undergrad major and a film school graduate degree. What I did have was a lot of debt. My father had just died, and I was sort of in Los Angeles living in a tiny, crummy apartment without much hope. And my mother in Michigan would say things like, well, just hope that pretty soon you'll give this up and come home because you seem so miserable all the time. It's familiar to me what you describe. And I ended up getting a bunch of jobs answering phones and doing other low wage work just to pay the bills. And it was very depressing and didn't nourish me in any kind of a soulful way. So my free time was not spent doing the creative work that was ultimately going to get me out of that rut. Like I say, it went on for about 2 years. What I learned is that it's part of the process, and that the only thing you cannot do is stop writing. No matter how bad it gets, no matter how many couches you're surfing on, no matter how far away your goals seem, you cannot stop writing. Because it's kind of your obligation as an artist. You were given this drive to do so, and letting the world come between you and your love to do this work is the ultimate failure. The rest of it is, as I have heard other teachers say, the laundry list will come out in the wash. But you cannot let the world divorce you from your passion. That is the one thing you must cultivate, is the discipline and the strength to hold on to it and remain true to it, even if you're eating ramen every night. And for me, also going back to the filmmakers and writers who inspire me and who started me on the path of thinking this might be something I'd like to do always helps me. I've always loved Nancy Meyer's work. I liked to see the combination of sweetness and realness that she brought to characters and things like Father of the Bride or even in Irreconcilable Differences. I love Eileen McKenna because I feel like she tells female stories that aren't sappy romantic comedies all the time, like Devil Wears Prada. Mm-hmm. It kind of changed the way we thought about female movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've always loved Alvin Sargent. Ordinary People was one of those movies where I thought, you can do that? You can just point a lens at the raw, messed up, contradictory, ugly parts of ourselves like that. And Alexander Payne, I feel like, is the same way. People are not perfect. They're, in fact, incredibly complicated, self-sabotaging, irresponsible creatures. And watching them wrestle with that in an honest way is what rivets all of us to the screen. And remembering that humanity in the work of people that inspired me would help me remember why I wanted to do this in the first place. And it would sort of bring me back to my keyboard and help me keep trying. So I feel like that's, for me, always been a useful approach. I mean, I think you also have to just remember that as an artist, you have to take your life seriously. And you have to read and you have to nourish your brain, and you have to have a very high standard for yourself. And when you really focus on that, it's like you stop worrying about what everybody else is thinking about you. You stop worrying about screenwriting contests and the guy that got more praise on his script in the last workshop than you, or somebody who got the part that you didn't get. You kind of don't have room to worry about that because you're so busy sort of adhering to your own standards and working on getting yourself to the best place you know you can be. I like to run, and I'm training for the marathon.
Wow. Katie, are you serious?
Yeah, I love it. It's just,
you are so badass. I love
well,
you.
I like
oh
it.
My gosh.
For me, like a moving meditation, I always say. But you know, when you're training, the coaches say, run your own race. Run your own race.
Yeah.
And I think that's just true in this business too, because otherwise you're just not going to leave your house in the morning. I mean, it's hard enough to do what we do. If we start measuring success externally in these ways, particularly when we're down, particularly when we're just starting out, when we're just beginning to touch the gift we've been given to express ourselves creatively. I mean, that's the thing that you have to remember about creative people. As the great Nina Foch, one of my teachers, used to say, we are the descendants of priests and teachers and storytellers by campfires and cave walls from the beginning of man. So we have a very noble and difficult task, which is to carry forth the truth of what it is to be human. That is a high bar to reach for. And if you really want to get to it, you need to stop worrying about what everybody else thinks, because it's going to take all the energy you have to really try to tell the most honest versions of the stories that you are here to tell in whatever way they are, writing, acting, etc. So these kinds of things help me out of ruts, which I still get into all the time. I still have notes sessions that leave me feeling beaten down. I still go up for jobs that I don't get. You have to find this way to talk to yourself and get yourself down off the ledge and back to the keyboard.
Thank you for that. That was so awesome. I literally had like several questions lined up, and you just knocked it all out in that one answer. Thank you for that. Katie, I know you're running out of time, so let me squeeze in one more question. How important do you think it is to have mentors in your path as a writer? And what kind of advice would you share if you were a mentor?
I think it's essential. I think it's essential to have people who have the wisdom and the perspective that can really help you on your path. And it's been true for me since I was 10. I had my first, that teacher that made you realize maybe you could do more than you thought you could. And from that time on, I feel like I've just collected people who see me in, they almost see you in a way that you'd like to see yourself. They sort of help you step into your own capabilities and your own aspirations, because they have the kind of breadth and depth of experience to sort of allow them to see maybe what you can't. So I absolutely think that seeking out people who you respect and admire, whose opinion you value, you know, is very important. It has been key. And the advice that I give to people, you know, to the extent that anybody would ask me to be a mentor, is everything that I just said about finding a way to talk to yourself, to cultivate the discipline to do this work, to remember how important it is that you don't let anything come between you and your passion, but also to look for a life of balance. I think when I was in my 20s, before I was married, I spent a lot of time talking about how busy I was and how little time I had for anything. And now I have a career and a husband and two children, and I laugh at the time that I had available to me, and I don't know what the hell I spent it doing. But what I have now is this kind of fullness and richness of experience outside of myself that, weirdly, like, you discover more, you just make more room, and I wouldn't trade it, because I feel like I have a better balance kind of as a human being with this crazy, wacky family of mine. It's funny, like on the red carpet at the prom premiere, I am wearing this dress and I'm, you know, trying to be very glamorous. And I'm also kind of pregnant with my first child. And so you see me kind of standing there sort of cradling my little belly. But I think it really ended up looking like I was modeling my beard. So it's not that glamorous. And I looked back, and at first I was like, oh man, like my one big moment there. And I literally look like a lady with a beer gut. That moment is so true. That is me.
So honest.
Yes. And in the end, I wouldn't have it any other way. In the end, my daughter and I will laugh down the road, and I will say, you were on the red carpet with me.
Exactly.
And so I have a different perspective of what I imagined that moment would have been and what it ultimately really was. And I can appreciate that with a sort of more balanced view. So I think that that's an important thing to remember too. I think it's important to just try to remember that life is long and that the world is a big place. And like, you're not necessarily at the center of it. And that's actually a good thing. I think these kinds of humbling moments can actually inform us as artists and help our work down the road. But I don't want to sound dismissive of how difficult the challenges can be, which makes rising to them and overcoming them all the more triumphant, right?
Yeah, you're so right about that. And you know what? I'm so happy you didn't sugarcoat anything. I think that's the problem nowadays, is that the work we need to put in to receive the kind of results that successful storytellers like you have achieved are glossed over, especially by social media. So a lot of us are going about life and our careers with rose-colored lenses. And if and when we do hit rock bottom, it's really difficult for some of us to push through it because it was so unexpected.
I think you're so right about that. And I think ultimately it's also in service of your work. Like, do you think that you could get performances like Alexander Payne gets in Sideways or Election or About Schmidt if he didn't understand like the depth of human despair, darkest moments, like when we really don't see the way out of whatever problems we're in, the worst of ourselves? I mean, if you don't have intimate personal knowledge of that, how are you going to write about it in an honest way? So it's a necessary element. It cannot be that you aspire to something and someone just hands it to you. That would be like saying, I want to go fishing and someone hands you a fish.
And that would be really boring too, honestly. What kind of life would that be? You know, it's fun with challenges. Katie, thank you so much for that. So before you go, do you have a book that's your ultimate favorite and why it's so meaningful to you that you could recommend to the listeners? Perhaps something that has helped you with your writing or that you refer back to once in a while if you feel a little lost? Is there, like, for me, it would be The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. I feel like that's, a lot of people love that book.
That's a great book.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book because I get a lot of writer's block, if you know what I'm saying.
I agree with you a lot about that one. I also think Blake Snyder is very useful when it comes to the actual approach to writing.
Ooh, Save the Cat. Nice.
There's a nonfiction, well, actually, I think she's a fiction and nonfiction writer named Anne Lamott, who wrote a book called Bird by Bird, which is sort of about the process of writing and overcoming the difficulties when it's not going well, that I recommend. I'm reading a lot of nonfiction these days, but I go back and forth. And I also read a lot of scripts. I read television and feature scripts because even just one turn of phrase can still take my breath away and give me something. Give me something to aspire to and be inspired by. And I think that it's really important to remember how much you need to read. And that you have to take that very seriously because we have to constantly feed our brains. We have to constantly find different ways of looking at things. And that's ultimately the goal of art, right? To get us all to be a little bit surprised by what we're feeling and what we're seeing and recognizing ourselves in something that we didn't expect. I think those moments are easier to kind of reach for when you're letting it happen for yourself too, in your own writing and the things that you're watching. I had a teacher who said, you are no longer a civilian. You know, if this is the path that you want to be on, then when you go to a movie or you read a book, you have to come at, you can't just let things wash over you. You have to eat all of this and use it for your own work. And so I would say more than any one book that it's just important to read a lot.
Yeah. And if anything, if our listeners out there, you are not able to write every day, although you really should, you should at least minimum be reading every day. I feel like that's something we could both agree on for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Katie. You've stayed for another question for me, and that's amazing. I'm so grateful. So I'm going to let you go now so you can get back to work because Katie's amazing. She ended up going, you're at work right now, right? In your studio at Paramount doing this interview for us. So thank you so much, Katie. You are incredible. Please send my love to your family and have an amazing day
at
work.
Thank you, Ian. You too. Thanks for doing this. I think it's really important to give this to people to listen to and really think about. I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Oh, thank you, Katie. And I'm so blessed to have you as my first.
I know, I'm so lucky.
This is awesome. Thank you, Katie. And I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Bye-bye.
Hey, Storyteller Tribe, I hope you enjoyed Katie's uplifting episode. If you'd like to thank Katie or want to say hi and check in on the most recent TV shows and movies she's working on, be sure to follow her on Twitter at StickHippo. That's spelled StickHippo. Also, check out Katie's show notes page for links to the books and resources that were brought up in her interview at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Katie Wesch. As mentioned at the top of this episode, I'd love for you to get to know the team behind Scrivener. We have Julia Pierce, the head of marketing, with us today to talk a little bit about Scrivener. Julia, I'm so happy to have you on the show right now. I'm such a huge fan of Scrivener. Funny thing is, I actually learned about you guys through one of my guests I interviewed for the show. She's a best-selling novelist of an Oprah's Editor's Pick and an O. Henry Prize winner. So yeah, you better believe that I most definitely checked out the software she uses for her writing. I'm so grateful to her for mentioning you guys, and I'm so thrilled to have you as an official sponsor of 88 Cups of Tea. So let's get right into it. Tell me how Scrivener has helped you with your work, and what do you love about it?
The idea behind Scrivener is that it was developed for writers. My background's in journalism, so it's really, really helped me. For instance, when you're writing a feature, you might have different sources. You might have different interviews with different people. The beauty of Scrivener is that it allows you to get everything into one place. So beforehand, you might have had a few files in Microsoft Word. You might have had some stuff on a spreadsheet in Excel. And you're sort of thinking to yourself, oh, I know I made some notes about this. And I know I spoke to this person. But what did I call that file? I'm searching through my computer. I can't find anything. But with Scrivener, you can drag it all into one folder. Everything's in one place at your fingertips. So whenever you're looking for something, you can just do it straight away. And you can pull in things like videos, you can pull in audio files as well. So it's a very, very flexible tool. A lot of writing software is built with a particular style in mind or going through a particular process. You may have to fill in character sheets and so on before you can actually get into the software itself and start writing. We don't believe in that at all. What we think is that everybody writes, all writers are completely different. They have their own individual styles and ways of doing things. So the idea behind Scrivener is that Scrivener doesn't get in the way. It molds to your style. You think about how you would like to write, whether you like to plan everything first or whether you like to just sit there and write everything and then at the end go, now I need to organize everything, now I need to go back and edit and think, did I say Steve had blue eyes at the beginning and now he's a tall man with dark eyes? And I'm sure everybody who's listening who's an author knows, oh yeah, continuity. We have all these things within the program. You just mold it to whatever you need to do, really.
Yeah, that's what I love about Scrivener too. I actually jumped into your software thinking it was just for people who wanted to write books, but I realized a few days into that, it's so perfect for any kind of writing, any kind of research and organization. It's actually perfect, especially for someone like me who's so scatterbrained with all these ideas and thoughts I need to collect and jot down. And you guys have made my life so much easier because I used to get so annoyed having to switch back and forth between all of my documents that were stacked on top of each other one by one at the very bottom of my desktop screen. So then you'd have to kind of like skim through and look through and keep clicking all these buttons. So I would always lose my train of thought because I was so busy trying to find all of these hidden images and PDFs and Word documents. So just a few days into using Scrivener, I realized really quickly that not only can I use it for a more organized way of getting ideas down for a novel, but I've also used it to create the content for my podcast's website and setting up contracts and even business emails. I feel like every time I use Scrivener, I always discover brand new features and I'm like, whoa, where did that one come from? I'm sure there's a lot more features that I'm not aware of yet. So why don't you tell us about one of your absolute favorite features on Scrivener?
Actually, the one feature that I really do like is when you go into the corkboard and you can stamp each individual card with a message sort of like done, needs editing, final draft, something like that. I just find it really, really easy to go back through chapters of things that I'm writing and just to quickly flick onto corkboard view and just see, actually, no, I've done that. It's nice to be able to see your progress as you go through and just mark that done, done, done. It's just the way my mind's organized.
Yeah, definitely just go for it. I actually went through the Active tutorial myself and it really helped a lot in figuring out how to use Scrivener because it can be overwhelming in the beginning. And I'll also have to jump on the video tutorials because that sounds really helpful too. So thank you so much for sharing your take on Scrivener, Julia. And that wraps it up, guys. As you can see, I'm so proud to partner with Scrivener as I really do believe in them. And if you haven't used them yet, I really encourage you to download their free trial and check it out for yourself. I want this tool to help you as much as it's helped me. So if you decide that you do love it, Scrivener has a very special offer just for our Storyteller tribe. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/scrivener and enter promo code 88cupsoftea at the checkout page for a 20% off discount. Thank you guys so much for tuning into my very first episode. I'm so grateful for your support, and I'm really excited to be on this journey with you. It would really mean the world to me if you take action with the advice and tips mentioned in Katie's interview. I want to see you progress in your career and in life, and I'd really love to hear how the episode helps you in any way. So head on over to Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram and find me at 88 Cups of Tea and let me know how Katie's episode resonated with you.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.